Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with saxophonist, composer, and jazz journeyman Sam Newsom. During our interview, Sam talked about growing up in Maryland and all the jazz that was there, his innovative approaches to jazz that are full of non-Western sounds, his switch from the tenor to soprano sax, some pretty cool Donald Byrd stories, and so much more about what is going on and what he would like to see happen in the future. Please dig it, my friends.
Hey, thank you for taking a little time out to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm going to go ahead and start right off the bat and ask, what has been going on lately with you?
I've been dividing my time between really three different areas. You know, I'm a devoted family man. You know, I have a four-year-old daughter, so as you can imagine, if one has kids, you know, that's certainly an area that demands a lot of your time 24/7.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But it's all great, though.
Oh, yeah.
And also, as you may or may not know, I'm a full-time music professor at Long Island University in downtown Brooklyn. So our semester just started. So I've been actually just dealing with the ins and outs of running co-running a music department.
Right on.
Been great, and you know, and again, very time consuming, but there's still a lot of fun. And I guess the third area I've been working a lot. I guess been two different bands. You know, been playing with the Bad Plus. They have a new project called Science Fiction, where they play the music for Ornette Coleman.
Cool.
And we just got that from a gig Saturday. We played at in Boston at the Berkeley Performance Center.
Oh, cool, man! Yeah, the Bad Plus, they're great, man. I love those guys.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun playing with them. And for them too. You know, they've been playing with a trio for so many years. So I imagine it's kind of, you know, good for them just to have, like, all of these other influences now, because now the front line is Ron Miles on trumpet, Tim Byrne on alto, and myself on soprano. So as you imagine, there's just a lot of other ideas flowing now.
Yeah, you know, if there's ever an outfit out there that would never shy away from more, it would be a jazz group, you know. I'm going to go ahead and start at the beginning of your lineage in your life in Salisbury, Maryland. How did this town lend to you getting a love and an appreciation for jazz?
Well, fortunately, during that time, music was a big part of the education in the public school system. So the way that it usually worked, the way that it worked in the public school system in Salisbury, Maryland, is that in the fourth grade, everyone learned the recorder. So that was sort of your introduction to music. And then in the fifth grade, you had the option of learning a string instrument or a band instrument. So you could learn the cello, violin, viola, or maybe even the bass violin, or the band instruments were, you know, it's used as a typical trombone, trumpet, saxophone, and maybe tuba. So that was really great, because it's like, you know, it wasn't even a big effort to actually learn music, because it was just a part of the curriculum. So unfortunately, you know, I think we live in a time where if kids want to learn music, you know, either they have to go to sort of one of these specialized performing arts schools, or they have to, you know, learn it in some type of after school program, which is okay too, but it's nothing like just having it to be a part of your daily learning.
So what was it about the saxophone that allured you to it in the beginning?
The saxophone, at least during that time, it was just an instrument that was just very present. Meaning it was an instrument I saw and heard when I went to a parade, or during that time, during the 1970s, you used to hear a lot of horn sections, you know, like a, you know, bands like Kool and the Gang, Earth, Wind and Fire, Power. So all of these different bands had horn sections, and of course, in various fusion and even straight ahead jazz context. So it's just of all the instruments, it just seemed to be the most present. So I was just naturally drawn to it.
Right on. What was your first gig like? Were you nervous? Like when you really hit the big stage and you were there and the adrenaline was going, were you nervous? How did you feel?
Well, you know, my first actual performance where I this jazz performance was actually in the I think I was in the eighth grade. So I may have been maybe 13, maybe 14, and I remember I had to stand up and take an improvised solo, in the concert, and I just remember I was so nervous that going into it, but after playing the solo just on the big stage and just in front of the audience and just sort of hearing the applause, I was on a natural high after that.
Yeah.
Literally for like for 2 or 3 days, and I never had that overwhelming type of feeling before, and I feel like I've just sort of been sort of hooked on it ever since. And mind you, it wasn't just the applause and being on stage. It was just being able to tap into another side of myself that was very enticing. So of course, you try to do it better and better. So that led to me, studying, buying records, taking lessons with people, going to hear live performances. So all of those things sort of led to me wanting to do this other thing better.
Sounds like the healthiest drug addiction in the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about your latest album, Straight Ahead Horn of Africa. I love how you blend so many levels of non-Western into the way that we don't typically think of music. Talk to me a little bit. You're on volume 2 now. Talk to me a little bit about this project.
This project is, it's part of a continuum, because it's the fifth solo record, but that's just the actual fourth studio record.
Yeah.
Because it started in 2007 when I released Monk Abstractions, on which I explored like many of the popular songs of Thelonious Monk. And since then I released Blues Soliloquy, The Art of the Soprano, Volume 1. And then I released a solo concert that I performed at the New Music Festival in the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And then the most recent CD, The Straight Horn of Africa, that's really picked up from where The Art of the Soprano Volume 1 left off. And as you probably know from the from the CD, the whole concept of the CD was really taking the sort of the idea or the paradigm of the African drum ensemble, and in recreating that or reimagining that, solely through the soprano saxophone. Because if you check out the early records, I use various extended techniques. Probably the one I use most commonly is the percussive slap tone. And I've always used that, to sort of recreate the sound of a drum, through my performances. But on this record, it was the first time that I really made a conscious effort of really only doing that. So it was kind of an experiment where I already took a concept that was already very focused and singular, and I narrowed the scope even more.
Let me go back a little bit into your lineage here in the beginning of your playing. You had to have learned a tremendous amount in the early 90s with Terrence Blanchard. What were those years like for you?
Oh, they were definitely my formative years. Because mind you, that was probably the first gig that I did on an extended basis, you know, after having graduated, you know, from the Berklee College of Music. So, you know, so I was an opportunity that I was able to take all of the things that I learned in the classroom and apply them in a real life musical situation, because there's nothing in the classroom, I think, that can really can prepare you for what it's like to not only be on the road and having to play someone's music night after night, but then being able to delve deeper into the music and to find your own voice, you know, because oftentimes in music education, you know, it's all about accumulating things, you know, it's about taking influences from this person and that person, you know, it's about repertoire building or vocabulary building. But I think when you make that transition from student to artist, you know, that's when it becomes more about your personal voice, you know, not necessarily showing people what you have studied, but being able to find a unique way or creative way to meld or mold those influences into something that's personal or into something that's uniquely your own. So that gig gave me an opportunity to do those things.
Right on. What about your time with Donald Byrd? Did you learn quite a bit from that time period as well?
I did, actually. Unfortunately, it was very short-lived, because that was my first gig, actually, after graduation. You know, as you can imagine, as a young music student, and you know that graduation is like, you know, a couple of months away, you always have that hovering question of, okay, now what? What am I going to do now?
Yeah.
And, but fortunately, one of my teachers at Berklee at the time was pianist Donald Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like a month or so before graduation, Donald, you know, he's just sort of, I saw him sort of around Berklee. He was like, so what are you going to be doing after graduation? Are you going to move to New York and stick around Boston? So I told him I was, you know, looking to move to New York, because he said, well, I have something that you might be interested in. So I won't tell you what it is right now, but, you know, I'll get back to you. So, you know, he sort of kept me on pins and needles for a while. And then he called me up and said, maybe a few weeks later, so yeah, you know, I'm going on the road with Donald Byrd, you know, over the summer. And, you know, originally he was going to use Junior Cook, but he decided that he wanted to, you know, get a younger player. You know, he's always been to finding, you know, to up-and-coming talent. So I told him about you. So he said, are you interested? So I was like, yeah, of course. So that was sort of my first sort of major gig. And in that band at the time, it was Donald Brown, of course, on piano, Ron McWhorter on bass. I don't think he did much in New York. He was mainly a Boston guy. And Billy Chilson on drums. So we did sort of a few weeks in Europe, maybe a little longer. But that was really, not only was it my first sort of European tour, but it was my first time really on the main stage. So that was a great experience. And just listening to all of the stories that he had to tell. I mean, this is someone who played the Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Thelonious Monk, Art Blakey. So I mean, I remember we had one gig in Pittsburgh, and so we drove from New York to Pittsburgh, and I swear he talked. I mean, it was like a 6-hour drive, and he talked the entire time. I don't think any of us had gotten one word in. It was just all stories about people he had played with, just his perspective on the world. I mean, it was just, I mean, really, it was like getting an
Yeah. So what was one of the best stories he had?
Well, I always loved the one about Billy Joe Jones. Where he said, well, of course, Billy Joe Jones is from Philadelphia. And he said before Billy Joe had really made it full-time as a musician, he used to drive the streetcars. So what he used to do oftentimes was he would drive the streetcars, and when he got in front of a jazz club, you know, where they were playing, you know, he would get off the car, go play a tune. and then when the tune was up, and then after he finished playing, he would get back in the car and start driving again. So he would just sort of spend the whole day doing that.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. You know, you're a guy that's not afraid of challenges or changes or doing things that are not status quo. You went from the tenor to the soprano sax. What was that all about? Why did that happen?
Well, I mean, it happened during a period. I definitely call that my contemplative time. There just wasn't a lot going on gig-wise. And it was, so I just had a lot of time just to experiment and to think about, you know, where I want to go next musically. Because as you may or may not know, a lot of times, like when you are approaching the age of 30, you sort of feel like, okay, this is a point where you're no longer looked at as just being a young man. You know, it's like you really have to embark upon a path that you feel is really something you plan to be on for the rest of your life. So I was sort of at this sort of crossroads. So I started playing the soprano more, and it was the type of thing I hadn't really played it that much, but it was like I think I had someone had called me for a gig that required me to play soprano a lot. So I was like, well, this would be a great opportunity for me to get my chops up on it. So it was during this time that I was actually working on it a lot that I started to hear things that I didn't hear when I was playing the tenor. And it was like, it was very inspiring for me. And during this time, I was very dissatisfied with my playing on the tenor, you know, particularly my sound. So when I started playing the soprano, you know, I just found that the soprano was more liberating, and it was actually just more inspiring sonically.
Yeah.
So it started to get to a point where I was practicing both, but then I found while I was practicing the tenor, I couldn't wait to put it down so I could play the soprano. And then it just got to the point where I just decided not to pick up the tenor. And I just said to myself, well, this seems to be something that feels right, so I'm just going to go for it.
Right on.
At a time where I felt either I did it then or I wasn't going to get the opportunity again. Because had I waited until I got busier, that would have been more difficult. So it was just a perfect opportunity, so I just seized the moment.
Right on. You have interjected North African, Japanese, and Middle Eastern vibes into your music. How did all of that come about?
I think a lot of it stems from the soprano. I mean, I think the soprano, just sonically, I think it has a versatility, almost like a cross-cultural versatility that the other saxophones don't have. You know, there are elements of the soprano that sound like a bansuri flute, which is a wooden flute from Japan. There are elements of the soprano that sound like double reed instruments that you find in North Africa or in Middle Eastern countries. There are elements of the soprano that, you know, that sound like the flute, that sound like the oboe. So just sonically, there's like all of these different instruments in this one sound. So was able to learn a lot from listening to different styles of music. So it's from checking out the different instruments, I started to like the music as well. So I integrated, you know, a lot of those things that I was hearing into my jazz concept.
Speaking of learning, what do you want the kids that you teach at Long Island U to get from what you're giving them? What's your philosophy on teaching?
Well, I always try to teach my students that first and foremost, you have to be yourself. Because when you get out into the professional world, chances are the people who are in a position to hire you oftentimes have heard a lot of great music, you know, particularly if you have the privilege of playing with someone, you know, who happen to be several years your senior. So chances are, you know, they've heard all of the hit licks, they've heard, you know, lightning speed of passages, you know, they've heard like the impeccable technique. But what they most likely haven't heard is you. So I always tell them, like, I think that's the best way that you can impress someone is to let them hear your personality. So no matter what they're learning, the ultimate goal should be to find themselves, to find their own voice, and to be the best them that they can be. Because ultimately, being an original will be what separates you from the pack.
Right on. Who are your heroes?
Well, on soprano, I mean, certainly Sidney Bechet, Steve Lacy, Wayne Shorter, Dave Liebman, Branford Marcellus, a lot of people, Evan Parker, John Butcher, Lowell Coxfield. I mean, I get so many things from the different players, and they're not the same kind of thing. So my what I'm listening to, you know, at a particular time, just depends on sort of what I'm into at that moment.
Yeah.
So, but I just have a whole laundry list of people that I like to listen to. But ultimately, I'm into, you know, just great work. I mean, that's what inspires me. So it doesn't even necessarily have to be music. You know, I could be inspired by a great movie, you know, a great speech. You know, I remember recently when I did the gig with the Bad Plus that I mentioned earlier in Boston, Tim Byrne and I took the Amtrak up to Boston together. And I remember sort of halfway through the trip, you know, I told him, I said, I'm going to put on my headphones, I'm going to listen to the Ornette record, Science Fiction. So I was going to see if I could get inspired for the gig. So I listened to it for about an hour or so, then I took their headphones off, and he says to me, he said, "So did it help?" I was like, "What do you mean?" He said, did you learn anything about the music they were going to play?" And I was explaining it to him. I said, "Well, I wasn't listening to it to find out how to play the music better or more correctly, but just to get inspired, you know, by the greatness of the artistry. So what they actually played didn't matter to me so much as far as me trying to emulate that. I was just listening just to get inspiration from their vision, just from the path that they walked."
Yeah, totally.
So that's how I deal with music and with art.
Speaking of music and art, and you look back on your career, is there a period of your creative existence you look back and say, "Man, that I grew leaps and bounds during that period"?
There have been a few. I guess one, I would definitely say the 4 to 5 years that I played in Terrence Blanchard's band. I mean, it definitely, I learned a lot as far as trying to find my own voice. And mind you, that was on the tenor. And then when I formed my group, Global Unity, in the sort of like the late 90s, working with, I guess, non-jazz musicians was a huge learning experience for me, because I guess I learned how to just connect with other musicians on the most basic and fundamental level. I mean it's a whole different discipline when you're working with like trained jazz musicians who can read any note, playing with any chord changes, to playing with, say, percussionists who can't read, and maybe it's very limited in sort of formal training, but they are familiar with a sort of with a certain folkloric language. So it's learning when I learned how to communicate with them, you know, it really I think taught me to recognize the core of my concept in the core of whatever vision that I was trying to get across. Because then it helped me to, I think, even become more singular in my creative efforts, because then I could, in many ways, just trim away the fat of the vision and get to the more essential of what I was trying to develop.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there anybody out there in the world of jazz that you would love to play with and have not played with yet?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of, especially a lot of younger artists that I kind of know, but haven't really played with them so much. You know, I really like what Jason Moran is doing, you know, and like Vijay Iyer, some drummers. There was Rudy Royston and I had talked for a while about doing a sax drum record. So it hasn't happened yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to that coming about. There are a lot of people. I can't really pinpoint anyone, but there's a lot of great stuff going on. So I hope that my path can cross with some of those guys who are out there really doing their thing.
Right on. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
I think for me, I think as an artist, I think the great thing about waking up every day is knowing that you can do something that matters. You know, oftentimes, you know, people work these sort of menial jobs that, you know, where they go their lives, you know, being virtually unnoticed, you know, being cogs in the wheel. But the great thing about being an artist is that you can make your statement, you know, about the world as you see it. And unfortunately, being in this day and age of the DIY musician, the do-it-yourself musician, you know, we don't have to wait for a record company to pick us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can pick ourselves. You know, if we want to make a record, the industry is such that we can do it. You know, all we need is a recorder. You know, we can even make it on our iPhones if we wanted to. We could download an app that could enable us to make a decent quality record, you know, in that way. So we're living in an age where it's very easy to get product out there. So the great thing about waking up is, you know, being able to make a statement about the world and having other people care about it.
So I hear you almost had a career in comedy. You attended some open mic nights with Dave Attell. Did you miss your calling?
Yeah, probably not. I think at best, I probably could have been a good comedy writer.
Very cool.
I don't think I had the stomach for it.
I think
what really made me, one of the reasons that made me stop was just having, being in front of some really bad audiences.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing when things are going really well. You're like, oh man, I can do this. but like to be, but to when it goes like just horribly wrong, and not necessarily because of anything that you did, but sometimes it's just a room. It's like some people, they're there only to make your life miserable.
Yeah.
And I think some people, they would get off on that. They would, they would be like, "Hey, bring it on! I can pick anything that you can dish out."
Yeah.
But I don't think I had that.
Yeah.
but I certainly had that for music.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything that anyone could dish out that would deter me from my path.
Yeah. Right on. Let's say we catch up here in about 10 years and talk. What would you be, if I said to you in 10 years from now, what's been going on, what are you going to be happiest about telling me that happened?
Well, I like the path that I'm on. I would just like to continue doing what I'm doing and just doing it better. And one thing that I recently started to embark upon is sort of developing my writing. In fact, with this new CD, The Straight Horn of Africa, I released an Amazon Kindle essay, that discussed not only the process of making a record, but a lot of the inspirational thoughts that I was working with while making the CD. So I released that as sort of like a Kindle single. So that's sort of the beginning of sort of this new thing of mine as a writer. In fact, I completed a book of personal essays that I'm going to release sometime in 2015.
Cool.
And so I think the book is called Life Lessons from the Horn, Essays on Jazz, Originality, and Being a Working Musician.
Yeah.
So I think if I look back, 10 years from now, I would definitely like to see me having made developments as a writer, as well as a saxophonist.
Cool. So in the length of our 21st century friend Twitter, I want to ask you, tell me who you are in the length of a tweet or in a sentence. So anybody that wants to wonder who Samuel Newsom is, this is who you are.
I'm an artist, soprano, saxophonist, and I am a seeker of oneself.
Right on, man. Sounds great. Thanks again. And hey, continued success.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Sam for his skillful interview touch, stories, and all of that wisdom. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store or visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.